Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, this is Stephen Cohen from Colorado Springs here for episode 4 of the podcast, Quantitative Investigations. This episode is going to be about guns and gun violence, and I'm hoping to tick as many people off as possible. I am joined here today by Goose the Engineer. Say hello.
Goose in the house. It's Goose.
Isn't it really like Goose on the Nest?
Goose is in the nest. Ooh-wee. Goose is here. Here to keep everyone awake.
And what is it that we are indulging ourselves with today?
Today, we've got none other than a Chick-fil-A milkshake. I've actually never had a Chick-fil-A milkshake before, and I'm pretty impressed. But we'll see if I make it through the episode without horrific stomach pain. Because I've discovered that I'm slightly lactose intolerant. So I'll keep y'all updated as we traverse this course. Right. How this milkshake is traversing me.
Yeah, I can see the various noises and discharges as the podcast goes on.
If I stop giving feedback halfway through, you'll know why.
Yes. And if you leave the sound booth, I'll assume that you are using the facilities.
Correct.
So, now that we caught up on Goose's gastrointestinal issues, let's get on with the episode. As the usual, what we do is we kind of catch up on previous episodes or other interesting things. I had a very enlightening experience in the past couple of weeks. And it's so enlightening that I'm going to speak about it here. I finally realized why science seems to go wrong sometimes. I saw a video, and I saw this on LinkedIn. I saw a video, and it was by a Zimbabwean ecologist named Alan Savory. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his name, but it's spelled Savory, so that is how it is being pronounced. In this video, he was complaining that master's and PhD students do not really understand how to think about science. What he would do is he would take these master's or PhD students, take them in the field, and ecologists, of course, need to go in the field. And he would talk about various ecological issues. And the one response that he would get all the time is, I don't believe it, or I should say he'd get a question, is it in a peer-reviewed paper? And his response was, well, let's go out, let's observe, let's think, let's discuss. And in his words, they don't do it. The only response is it in a peer-reviewed paper or not? And his statement, in this video is, we are going to kill ourselves because of stupidity. I'm not necessarily ready to call this stupidity, but the implications of what Professor Savory was promoting, it's real. And I've had this experience. And the latest experience was a week after I saw this video, I was talking with someone I know, and master's degree in a science, and we were talking about climate change, and he actually started mocking some of the data that I was citing, which, of course, if anyone understands human behavior, when people are backed into an intellectual corner, when they are either unknowledgeable or incapable of coming up with arguments, there's certain behaviors that they exhibit. Number one is mockery, insults. Number two is yelling. Number three, on more of a mass scale, protests. And number four is violence. When people, in the end, are too unknowledgeable or too incapable of making arguments, they're too susceptible to being persuaded of various views, and they will, in the end, resort to violence. So after this person, as this person was mocking some of the data, And he was telling me what I didn't understand. And apparently I didn't understand the chemistry of heat trapment by carbon dioxide. I didn't understand that chemistry. And that is true. I do not understand that chemistry. What this person was incapable of doing was relating this chemistry of carbon dioxide trapping heat to the reality on the ground, which is carbon dioxide has been increasing since 2015. Well, actually since 1960, but in more recent, since 2015, and global temperatures have decreased. And he could not relate this research to that reality. And his response was, why don't you write a paper? And at that point, I won the argument. This person conceded the argument. This is the third time this has happened. And it was a stunning revelation because I had seen this video. This had just happened. This is the third time this has happened. And this person doesn't realize that they're conceding an argument, but they are also abdicating their intelligence to nothing but peer-reviewed papers. This person was completely discounting laws of physics, principles of thermodynamics. He didn't care. And he actually said that. You know, he said, well, you're just going back to your thermodynamics argument. That's right. That's what I'm doing because heat transfer is covered by thermodynamics. But he didn't care. He said, write a paper. Why don't you write a paper? My response was, why should I have to publish a paper documenting evidence that's already in the public purview? It's already available. Anyway, I found that interesting. The next recap, episode 2 was about energy policy. And I presented actual government data to show that solar farms and wind turbines were the least efficient forms of utility generation and the most incapable forms of utility generation. That's not to say it's a bad idea to put solar panels and wind turbines in your house or on your roof. I'm not saying that. That can actually be a good supplement to utility generation. But there was an article that I read about European energy prices, and that European energy prices have gone up significantly to the point where it is, I'm trying to find, there at this point there were a thousand euros or $1,000 per megawatt hour. And that was actually 10 times the price as it was about a year ago. And the reason it's happening is because Russia is messing with the gas, with the gas supply, and renewables are not able to pick up the slack. They're not. And energy price increases have occurred across the United States. Grid destabilization has occurred across the United States. You don't need me to tell you this. You can just go find articles on the interwebs yourself. You don't need me to tell you this. But it does happen. And there's nothing worse than having your power supply interrupted significantly. Unfortunately, we are a society, Western world, runs on electrical power. We need it, period, in addition to petroleum products and coal and others. So, for better or for worse, that's the catch-up. Is that okay with you, Goose?
Mighty fine with me. I'm about 25% of the way done my milkshake. So I think I'm making great progress. I'm trying to time it so that I don't have to sit through any of the podcasts without having milkshake.
Yeah. Woohoo. All right. Let's talk about guns and gun violence. This episode is going to go through the data of gun violence. And it's going to present two documents. These two documents provide a very good basis, good foundation for understanding gun violence in the United States. And anyone who has not at least perused these documents does not understand gun violence in the United States, except for those people who are victims of gun violence or the families of victims of gun violence and the perpetrators of gun violence. I'm not trying to diminish the knowledge of victims and perpetrators, but I am saying that for everyone who's sitting in the cheap seats watching this and sitting there in judgment, if they haven't gone over these documents, then they don't know much about gun violence. But before we do that, I do want to, for transparency, I do want to let everyone know I do own guns. I own an AR-15, a Remington 700 308 bolt action, and a Glock 19 9mm. I am a member of the National Rifle Association. I actually first joined the National Rifle Association in 2008 prior to me owning any weapons because I understand the importance of the Second Amendment, although the Second Amendment is not going to be the main focus of this episode. It's important to understand it. And I joined the NRA long term after I joined a gun club that is an NRA associated gun club. So therefore, you need to be a member of the NRA before you join the gun club. So that is my transparency testimony. Why don't we go over the Second Amendment? All right. Well, why don't we do that? So the Second Amendment states, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, I did that from memory, so if I have a word incorrect here or there, forgive me. So what does the Second Amendment mean? Well, we need to take it and dissect it a little bit. We need to take it in parts. First, let's look at what a well-regulated militia means. Some people think a well-regulated militia in the Second Amendment is the National Guard. Okay. Well, if you read the Constitution, everybody should read the Constitution at least once a year. It's not a very long document, but it is the founding of our society. It's the founding of our country, of our current form of government after the Articles of Confederation. So it is worth reading at least annually. Article 1 is powers of Congress. Section 8 actually delineates the powers of Congress. And one of those provisions in Section 8 entitles Congress to provide for calling forth the militia to execute laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Also in Section 8, Article 1, Section 8, Congress has the right to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Okay, so what does this mean? In the body of the Constitution, and as the Second Amendment is not formally the body of the Constitution, it is in the Amendments section, the Bill of Rights with the first 10 amendments. Article 1 in the body of the Constitution, Section 8, provides Congress the power to organize, arm, and discipline a militia, allows the states to appoint the officers, and has the authority of training the militia. Okay, the militia is, in this case, the National Guard. Okay, it is the National Guard because the National Guard falls under the purview of the states. The federal government can federalize the National Guard, which it has done probably in most conflicts that I remember, but the militia that's referred to in the body of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, is the National Guard. So, what is the militia in the Second Amendment? Well, in order to find this out, I had to do a little research, and I went to documents called the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers are a number of papers written by the founding fathers of our country. And there's one, it's called Federalist Number 46. I had to do a little research on the internet to figure out where most people say that the Second Amendment is addressed in the Federalist Papers. This particular one was written by James Madison. Now, I have to warn you, when attempting to read the Federalist Papers, I found them difficult to read. I'm not sure how James Madison ever got his point across back in the day, because it takes him forever to get to the point. And there's, and quite frankly, I found them so difficult to read. I think the Torah, which is written in Hebrew with no vowels and no punctuation, is easier to read. I actually think hieroglyphics might be easier. I think cuneiform or Klingon might be easier to read than the Federalist Papers. What do you think there, Goose?
You know, I think for sure listening to this podcast is easier.
That was a shot across the bow, my friend. Okay. So, what does James Madison say? And I'm going to read part of it, and then I'll explain what it means to me. And I will be perfectly honest here. This is going to be subjective, but as best as I can figure it, this is what the essence of the Second Amendment means, as it was written in Federalist Number 46. Extravagant as the supposition is, let it, however, be made. Let a regular army, fully equipped to the resources of the country, be formed, and let it be entirely at the devotion of the federal government. Still, it would not be going too far to say that the state governments, with the people on their side, would be able to repel the danger. The highest number to which, according to the best computation, a standing army can be carried in any country does not exceed 1/100th part of the whole number of souls, or 1/25th part of the number able to bear arms. This proportion would not yield in the United States an army of more than 25 or 30,000 men. To these would be opposed a militia amounting to near 500,000 of citizens with arms in their hands, officered by men chosen from among themselves, fighting for their common liberties, and united and conducted by governments possessing their affections and confidence. What is this saying? This is saying that the federal government can create an army, and if it were to impose its will or attempt to oppose its will by force on a state could mount an army significantly, orders of magnitude more larger than the army that can be mounted by or formed by the federal government. And that is the security of the free state. That is what, in my interpretation, James Madison is getting to the Second Amendment. Provides for the protection of the people against its government or against another government. There was a general in World War II, I cannot remember his name, but the essence of his statement was he was not afraid of the Japanese attacking the mainland United States, because behind every blade of grass would be an American with a rifle. That's the point. That is what the Second Amendment means. It's about the security of our state. It's not about being able to kill a deer with 10 rounds, according to the former governor, Andrew Cuomo. It's about the security of a free state. And that is why there are so many people, yours truly included, that firmly believe the Second Amendment ensures all of our other rights. So, with that, why don't we go on to data, okay? That's where I think we should go. There is a document, the first document that needs to be reviewed. It is called Priorities for Research to Reduce the Threat of Firearm-Related Violence. This is a document by the National Academies of Science. It's, according to the title page, it's the Institute of Medicine and National Research Council of the National Academies, but it is the National Academies of Science. This was a very good document. It was ordered by, this research was ordered by the by President Obama, and it wasn't highly publicized. But this is the first document that we should be reviewing, anyone should be reviewing, to understand gun violence, because it presents a lot of data in the introductory pages. And it's a lot to actually digest. But let's take a look at some of the data, okay? In 2010, there were twice as many non-fatal firearm-related injuries as deaths. In 2010, suicides accounted for more than 61% of the people who died from firearms. And actually, as you go through the data, suicide is either the most frequent cause of death by firearms, or it is a close second. Most of the times that I've seen, it is the highest number of deaths from firearms. That is really a sickening thought. And I know three people who have committed suicide. Only one died from a firearm. The other two died by means that I will not discuss here because it's too hard to discuss. But we as a society, if we know we have such a huge problem of suicide, we would think that we would mobilize the resources of this country to try and really solve this problem. Why are so many people killing themselves? Now, there are people who, unfortunately, from genetics, just have a chemical imbalance that causes such a depression that medicine is not going to cure, and they end up killing themselves. That's two of the cases that I know. But why are so many people killing themselves? If as a society, we can actually come together and stop and start looking at these problems, if we start looking at suicide, some of the benefit and actually reducing suicides, some of those benefits will undoubtedly carry over to a decrease in homicides. Mass shootings, for example, the Sandy Hook Elementary School, represent a very small fraction of all deaths. Since 1983, and this report, I apologize for mentioning, the data from this report, I believe, is from 2012, because the report is a 2013 report. Let me just check here. Don't want to give the bad information. Okay, 2013. This is a 2013 report. I think the data goes up to either 2010 or 2012. So, since from 1983, we'll say to 2010, for the sake of argument, 78 events, 547 victims, murder victims, homicide victims, and 476 injured persons. As opposed to, say, let's look at 2021. Homicides, 20,944. Suicides, 24,090. Mass shooting victims, 692. And spread out over a longer period of time, between 2007 and 2011, 68,720 people were murdered in firearm-related violence. Okay? So these numbers, memorizing the numbers is not necessarily the issue, but it's some of the other trends. So during the same 2007 to 2011 time frame, firearms accounted for more than twice as many murders as all other weapons combined. More than two-thirds of victims murdered by a spouse or ex-spouse died as a result of gunshot wounds. More than 600,000 victims of robbery and other crimes were perpetrated with a firearm. Okay? So let's look at patterns for homicide. And again, looking at these reports is very important, not necessarily for the actual numbers, but getting trends. Some of which I'm going to cover is some of these patterns. Well, when you look at the patterns, there's economic conditions, geography, that actually affects suicide and homicide rates. Homicides occur more frequently among youth in high-poverty urban environments and suicides occur more frequently among middle-aged males in rural areas. Okay, so let's cut to the chase. There is a racial component to all this. There's a racial component to suicide, and there's a racial component to homicide. Including homicides, suicides, and unintentional deaths, black males have the highest overall rate of firearm-related mortality, 32 per 100,000. It's twice that of whites and white non-Hispanic males. It's three times greater than that of Hispanic and American Indian males. So I'm sure everyone knew this, that there was a racial component. There's also a gender component. Homicides are much lower for females in general. And that's across the board for races. Males are more likely to be killed by firearms, and black males much more likely. Okay. So, what does this all mean? We're going to get to that. But between when it comes to the availability of firearms, there is this notion that the more firearms, the more gun violence. Between 1986 and 2010, the domestic production of firearms increased by 79%. Firearm exports increased by 11%, and firearm imports increased by 305%. And this is, by the way, I'm getting this data from that National Academies of Science report. Oddly enough, crime rates have declined over that same period. And if you look at the actual decrease in crime rates, It's actually pretty interesting. So there's another document, and this document is from the Bureau of Statistics. Hold on a second, I am pulling it up. It's from the Bureau of Justice Statistics from the Department of Justice. Now, I know the Department of Justice has a lot of issues. They have a lot of issues with trust and the trust in the DOJ is at a very low point right now, and they deserve it. However, when it comes to statistics, crime statistics, there's no other real choice. You have to go to the DOJ or some other nonprofit needs to get these statistics by every other jurisdiction. It's an insurmountable task. From 1990, so there's an April 2022 document called Trends and Patterns in Firearm Violence, 1993 to 2018. Unfortunately, 2018 is the latest year. the years after 2018, especially the COVID years, 2020 and 2022, are extraordinarily important and might even change the narrative. But we have to wait for that data to come out. There are other organizations that actually produce some of this data, but I'm going to stick with the Department of Justice, and because they seem to do a very good job at vetting and analyzing the data. From 1993 to 2018, it looks like homicides decreased from approximately 8.5 per 100,000 persons in 1993 to approximately 4.2, maybe 4.25 per 100,000 persons. That's one half. Now, I will tell you, most of that drop occurred between 1993 and 1999-2000, and it sort of flatlined from 2000 to 2022. Why? Why is it flatlining? I have no idea. I bet you Goose knows. Goose, do you have any idea why it's flatlined?
Sorry, I wasn't even paying attention at all.
That's what I thought.
Answering email. What was the question?
Don't worry about it.
I guess to be fair, I provided more comic relief by not even paying attention than by what I could have said. So,
yeah. That's okay. I'm barely paying attention to what I'm saying either. Anyway.
That's got to be a talent. I'll pay attention more now.
You don't have to.
I know I don't have to, but...
So notably, the rate of firearm homicides have been basically flatlined from 2000 to 2022. I have no idea why. It would be interesting to find out. And there was actually a little increase from 2014 to 2018. But overall, the rate of firearms homicides is down, but yet in that same period of time, the number of firearms available have increased. Getting to some more particular data on firearm sales, when you look at, there's data from the Bureau, from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, in 1999, we had a total of 9.1 million gun sales in that total year. In 2021, it appears that we had a total of 38.9 million guns. So the number of guns available, the number of guns in circulation has increased, but crime has decreased. Now, here's the question. As I said, we flatlined from about 2000 to 2022. Is it possible that the number of guns available or in circulation hit a point where it actually is affecting crime statistics? I don't know. No one knows, because I haven't seen any study on it. But when you look at the actual, and when you look at the actual number of firearms, of homicides, and I gave you a rate before, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the actual number of firearm victims between 1993 and 2018 has also decreased. In 1993, it was 18,300. In 2018, it was 14,000. So it's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. So where do we go with all this? Where do we go? Well, we still don't have the complete picture yet. Because what no one focuses on, when I first read the National Academies of Science report, is the first time I heard about defensive uses of guns. The data, according to the NAS report, the data are difficult to obtain. So these estimates, I don't know, are not very may not be very reliable. But according to the NAS report, annual defensive gun uses range from approximately 500,000 to 3 million. Think about that. 500,000 at a minimum. The National Academies of Science says there are 500,000 defensive uses of guns. Compared to, I just gave you actual statistics, 14,000 actual deaths in 2018. Okay. Now, I know in the very beginning I gave statistics on 2021. Those actually came from a non-DOJ organization, and so I'm not necessarily putting a high reliance on those. But think about that. In 2018, 14,000 people were murdered by firearms. If there were there could have been an additional 500,000 defensive uses of a gun. And actually, I'm going to go back because the NAS report, I think, goes to 2010. So in 2010, there were 11,100 people murdered. And let me see. And you add to that firearm victims. There were 415,000 firearm victims in 2010, add another 11,000. So that's 426,000 homicide victims and non-fatal firearm victims. Yet there were an additional 500,000 defensive uses of a firearm. Now, what is a defensive use of a firearm? It could be pulling your firearm and killing someone who's attacking you. Or it could be you're at a gas station pumping gas, and then all of a sudden two unsavory characters approach you. You show your firearm, you put your hand on it, and they walk away. That is a defensive use of a firearm. If those people who engaged in defensive firearm uses did not have those firearms, what would the victimization and homicide rates be? You have to wonder. You need to wonder. You need to look at defensive uses of firearms. Now, where do we go? It's a good question, because there is also, as I said before, there is also a racial component to all this. And the Bureau of Justice Statistics has numbers on the races of people who are victims and races of people who are perpetrators. Before we get to that, there's one more interesting set of statistics regarding firearms. In 2018, 64.4% of all homicides were perpetrated using a handgun. The rest were other firearms. What are those other firearms? Okay, you have semi-automatic rifles. You have bolt-action rifles. You have shotguns. I don't think anyone has been murdered from a flintlock, but I guess it's possible. Or some kind of muzzle loader. Handguns. So when you start looking at solutions, on what to do, what do you want to focus on? Okay, what do you want to focus on? And then, because in order to figure that out, you need to then start looking at the racial component. Okay. When you look at firearm homicides, this is one of the tables in the Bureau of Justice Statistics. This is table 6. Firearm homicides against persons by victim characterization. Okay, so these are victims. 22% of all victims were black. 22%. 1.8% were white. And then 4.6% Hispanic, 1.2% Asian, and 6.2% American Indian. So you get to see the vast majority of the victims of homicides are black. There's another table that I am trying to find, and that is a table of perpetrators versus the victims. And this is a pretty important table. And as soon as I scroll through and find it, I will let you know. Okay, here you go. So you have incidents of non-fatal firearm violence by characteristics of U.S. population, offenders, and victims. Okay. When it comes to number of incidents, the largest number of incidents, the offender was black. When it comes to the victims, the largest number of victims were white. Okay. The largest number of offenders of non-fatal firearm violence were black. This was 716,300, and this goes from 2014 to 2018. Now I know people are going to start to wonder why I'm talking about all this. Why am I talking about this? Why am I invoking race into this discussion? Am I a racist? I think the answer is no, but I'm sure people will have no problem in calling me a racist. When I see videos of firearm violence, and I've seen them on the news, I've seen approximately 10 videos in the past year. Out of those 10 videos, nine of those videos were perpetrated. The perpetrators were black using handguns. One video, the perpetrator was black using a semi-automatic rifle and was shot by the store owner who pulled out a shotgun. Now, how many people care that most of the offenders are black and they use handguns? How many people care? None. I should say none of those in power. Why do I say that? Because the second a person walks into a school with a semi-automatic rifle and shoots up the school, they want to ban that type of gun, in this case, the AR-15. I have spoken to people who have told me, I've spoken to people who have had relatives within a block or so of mass shootings like the July 4th shooting in Chicago, and would tell me, we have to do something. I would say, well, what about the 3,900 people who were killed in Chicago during the Obama administration? And the response was a callous, well, that's just drug dealers and gangs killing each other. Well, no, it's not. You have babies. You have unarmed women. You have unarmed men who are in the crossfire or just blatantly being murdered using handguns. Now, I have absolutely no propensity for any bans of any guns. But when someone sits there and tells me that we need to do something because this school is being shot up and it shouldn't happen, well, of course a school shouldn't be shot up. The best way to actually do that is to post armed and brave resource officers, police, in every school. Because some criminals may be mentally unstable, But when it comes to picking a target, they're not going to pick the target with the armed officer. They're going to pick the target where there's nobody. Now, in the Parkland, Florida high school shooting, they had armed resource officers. But they ran away. They didn't do anything. Also in Parkland, the FBI knew about the shooter, Nicholas Cruz, knew about him. Almost three dozen complaints against this kid. But yet, his firearms weren't taken away. Now, in Colorado, where I live, I've read the self-defense laws. And I can tell you that threatening someone's life with a firearm is a felony, period. You are not allowed to threaten someone with a firearm. You threaten someone with a firearm, you're found guilty. You shouldn't be able to, at that point, own a weapon. This guy on social media, Nicholas Cruz, was threatening a school with weapons. And nothing was done. Nothing was done. Until, of course, the actual shooting happened, and now all of a sudden they want to ban the AR-15. As I just showed you, a reduction in firearms is not going to prevent homicides, because just the opposite has happened. The more firearms that have been in circulation, homicide rates have decreased. Now, I am not claiming a direct cause and effect. Don't get me wrong. But just because you can't prove a direct cause and effect doesn't mean that it's not true. What it also does mean is that the arguments that banning guns saves lives is completely torpedoed at that point. But what I'm telling you is that I am actually sick of hearing people scream about mass shootings at schools when these same people could not care less about inner city people murdering each other on a daily basis. It is nauseating. It is nauseating. So what do we do? What do we do? I promise you one thing. I promise you that the federal government's not going to solve this problem. They're not going to solve this problem. And I'll tell you why. It's because it's a wedge issue. They need this issue. The politicians need this issue to try and concentrate their support, their power to get reelected. If you think I'm wrong, think about this. The Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court that nullified Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade was passed, I should say Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. 49 years have passed. And yet no one did anything, no one in Congress did anything to either codify Roe v. Wade or try and pass a constitutional amendment guaranteeing it. Now, this is not a statement on whether or not anyone supports abortion or not. That is not what I'm talking about here. I'm just stating facts. That 49 years have passed. The first time I ever heard hide or hair about codifying Roe v. Wade was when the Supreme Court decision was leaked. And all of a sudden, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, oh, we have to codify Roe v. Wade. They never codified Roe v. Wade. And the reason why they didn't do it was because they needed it as a wedge issue. They needed it to separate and concentrate power, divide and conquer. That's how some politicians act. This issue of gun violence is only going to be solved in the community. It has to start at the family. It has to go to the community, either through religious organizations or secular organizations. It has to start there. It's not going to be solved by the federal government. Gun violence is a cry for help from a society. And I'm not buying, we're just a society based that loves guns and based on violence, and that's why we have so much violence. No, I'm not buying that. Not at all. We have a sickness in our society, and it's not going to be solved by the federal government. Hey, Goose, what else do you think I need to cover here? He's not even paying attention anyway.
excuse me, I started paying attention. But you need to wrap it up because I finished my milkshake.
I probably rattled off enough statistics. In the end, what I'm going to have to say to wrap this up is that read the National Academies of Science document. And again, the title of it is Priorities for Research to Reduce the Threat of Firearm-Related Violence. It's a 2013 document. You can find it on the web, download it, take a look at the Bureau of Justice document, April 2022, Trends and Patterns in Firearm Violence, 1993 to 2018. These are foundational documents if you want to understand gun violence and if you want to start thinking about solutions. So with that, I'm going to wrap this up. Thank you very much. Hopefully I didn't put anyone to sleep. Again, this is Stephen Cohen, along with Goose the Engineer from Colorado Springs, bidding you a fond adieu.